Bible Worm, Bible Worm, reading the Bible with Bible Worm.
Welcome to Bible Worm, getting to the core of the biblical text. I'm Dr. Amy Robertson, Director of Lifelong Learning and Music at Congregation Or Hadash in Sandy Springs, Georgia.
And I'm Dr. Robert Williamson, Professor of Religious Studies at Hendricks College and Theologian in Residence of Canvas Community in Little Rock, Arkansas. We're here every week to discuss the biblical text, both as biblical scholars and as people of faith, one Jewish and one Christian.
Today we have a special episode for you. We are reading Mark's account of the Last Supper in Mark chapter 14, verses 12 through 42. What a story. We can feel the urgency in this supper, just like the original Passover meal, that something new and big and awesome and fearsome is about to happen, and there's no way you can really anticipate its magnitude. But alongside that, the text forces us to stare deeply into this frightening idea that no matter our convictions or our intentions, at the end of the day, we can't really trust ourselves. What do we do with that? How can we live with it? And maybe more importantly, what does Jesus do with it? Thanks for being with us. Bobby Williamson, what's the word?
The word is Maundy.
I was not expecting that. M-A-U-N-D-Y. It has too many letters to be the Wordle word, though.
Oh, it is. Yeah, it's true.
It'd be Maund.
Maund. That's a pretty good word.
I don't know if that's a word.
Yeah. Maund.
Yeah. We're reading a text we have not read together
ever.
Yet. Ever. Yeah. Ever. Something new under the sun, which is the text for Maundy Thursday.
That's true.
As you said. Last Supper text, I guess it also would be called.
Yes.
Mark's version of it. So in previous years, we have often done a special episode around this season, Good Friday, or I don't know.
Pretty much Good Friday, I think.
Pretty much Good Friday. Okay.
Yeah. You know, the first year we were going to kind of skip from Palm Sunday to Easter Sunday. And then one of our listeners, I don't remember who it was, emailed and said, you're going to do a Good Friday podcast, right? Because otherwise Jesus just goes straight from the triumphal entry to the resurrection and you miss the whole point. And so, that was a fair piece of advice. And so we did that.
And it was good for me because I had not read that text before. And the story makes considerably less sense.
It does. It does.
Leave out that
What's he being resurrected from? Like he just rode in on a donkey. Yeah. So for 4 years, we did the Good Friday text. We've done it in each of the Gospels. And then this year, someone in the Bible Worm Collaborative said, you know what? You've done Good Friday. We're going to release an old Good Friday. I don't know if we're going to release the Mark one, though, or not, because we were still a little crazy back then.
We'll release the best one.
Yeah. I don't know. We'll have to see. And then, and so they said, why don't you do the Maundy Thursday text this year? And so here we are.
Here we are.
Another good suggestion.
Although a good suggestion. And yet I will say this is one of those texts that I texted you as I was reading and was like, oh, Bobby, this is really stressing me out.
Yeah.
It's a very stressful story.
It is a stressful story. It's so interesting to read with you, especially on these new texts, because over time, you know, as a Christian reader, these texts just become so familiar. And you're like, well, of course, this is what happens. And so to have somebody who's a careful reader who knows the Gospels really well now and then see your response to it, it reminds me of, like, actually, it's a really sad,
poignant text. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. But I did not go to the grocery store and buy a pack of cigarettes as I told you I was going to do in my text. So that's good news.
What did you do instead?
My other, I shouldn't say other, I don't actually smoke. A thing I do for comfort sometimes is eat plant-based imitation meat products.
Yeah.
The more specific they are about what meat they are trying to be or like what preparation of what kind of meat, the more I am fascinated by them. So today I had these, they were supposed to be like pigs in blankets.
Yeah.
It was not good. Low tof, not good. But it doesn't matter. I eat, like, that's not the point. That's not the point.
The point is that they're trying real hard.
They're trying so hard.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
My story about you and favorite story about you and stress responses is, I think it was during our first year of graduate school, and I forget what the stressful thing was, but there was some stressful thing that happened to you in our graduate program, and you went out and got your nose pierced.
I did. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you came back and showed our professor, and you're like, you did this to me.
I did. Yeah, I think I got a B on my first paper, so I got my nose pierced.
Is that what it was?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I remember that paper. Not, I don't remember your paper. I remember my version of that same paper, which also was not a good one.
We try.
I tried.
Mm-hmm. So at least there's like a food theme to my stress response.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there's a food theme to this passage. That's a beautiful,
there
lovely connection.
There surely is. So the official narrative lectionary reading for today is Mark chapter 14, verses 22 to 42. That sort of has them start in the middle of their meal.
Right.
And so we decided to back it up a little bit to verse 12. So we get a little bit of setting before they're actually sitting at the table eating together. We read almost up to this point just last.
We did.
Just in our last regular episode, we read up to verse 9. So we've just had a couple of verses we haven't read. But is there, either in what we haven't read or just more generally, is there any context you want to offer us before we launch into this stressful story?
I think there's just a couple things that probably are worth noting. One is in chapter 14, in a piece we didn't read last week, in verses 1 and 2, it tells us, the text tells us that it was Passover, 2 days before Passover, and that the chief priests, the legal experts, were trying to arrest Jesus. Like, he had made them so mad, they want to arrest him. But it says they're afraid to do it during the festival because they don't want to cause an uproar in the crowd. And so we talked about this a little bit a couple of weeks ago about how the crowd is on Team Jesus at this point. And so they're afraid, like, arresting him publicly, this is going to be a problem. So at the beginning, right before our text starts, one of Jesus's followers, whose name is Judas Iscariot, decides to go to the chief priests, and he says, I can show you where Jesus is going to be in the middle of the night so that you can arrest him and not cause a controversy with the crowd. And so they agree, and then now we're sort of in the process, like that betrayal, turning in of Jesus is sort of happening in the background as we read our text. We know that it's underway, but it's not going to unfold until later on in this text.
Yeah, that's an important piece.
Yes.
Because that issue underlies a lot of the conversation that they'll be having around their dinner table.
Indeed.
Well, should we just go ahead and start then?
I think we should.
We have a lot of text to get through. Okay, so I am going to pick up in verse 12, and I am reading from the NRSV. On the first day of unleavened bread, when the Passover lamb is sacrificed, his disciples said to him, "Where do you want us to go and make the preparations for you to eat the Passover?" So he sent two of his disciples, saying to them, "Go into the city, and a man carrying a jar of water will meet you. Follow him. And wherever he enters, say to the owner of the house, 'The teacher asks, where is my guest room where I may eat the Passover with my disciples?' He will show you a large room upstairs, furnished and ready. Make preparations for us there." So the disciples set out and went to the city and found everything as he had told them, and they prepared the Passover meal. When it was evening, he came with the 12, and when they had taken their places and were eating, Jesus said, "Truly I tell you, one of you will betray me, one who is eating with me." They began to be distressed and to say to him, one after another, "Surely not I." He said to them, "It is one of the 12, one who is dipping bread into the bowl with me. For the Son of Man goes as it is written of him, but woe to the one by whom the Son of Man is betrayed. It would have been better for that one not to have been born." Mm.
I need a fake pig in a blanket.
Oh, man. Yes. Let it. that gets quite, it gets really heats up quickly there
it
at
does.
The end.
Yeah.
But let's go back to the beginning first. Mm-hmm. It tells us that it is the first day of unleavened bread and they ask where to go for the Passover. this, I don't know how consequential this is to the story, but it seems like maybe it's consequential for future Christian commemoration of this day.
Yes.
What do you think this meal, what is this meal? Are they just having dinner during Passover? Is that, what are they doing?
Well, I think this is actually the Passover meal. Mark is not particularly interested in the details of the meal. Like, he doesn't tell it, you know, with all the various steps and such. But it seems to me like this is not just dinner on a Thursday, but that this is the meal that is the commemoration of the Jewish celebration of the Passover. Mm-hmm. You know, in the time of Jesus, in the first century, Passover was still a pilgrimage festival. And so you were only allowed to eat the Passover meal in Jerusalem, really. So people travel to Jerusalem, but then they've got to have a place to have the meal. And so you've got like all of these people from all over the world coming into the city and sort of searching out places to have the meal together. And so people who actually lived in Jerusalem would often invite people either to share a meal with them or open up their guest rooms, like seems to happen here, and invite people into their homes. I'm curious what difference it makes for you reading this. Like when you think about this as a Passover meal, does that put your head in a particular kind of place reading the text, like that background?
That's a good question. I think what was sort of most urgently on my mind is that sometimes people will interpret this as a Seder and want to have a Seder. But that, as far as I understand it, a Seder, the way that we understand a Seder now, that was not at that time. So it might have been the Passover meal during which you would eat the roasted lamb and you would have unleavened bread, you know, sort of aligned with the way that the meal is described in Exodus 12.
Right.
But it's not, there was no like.
You're not like hiding the afikoman and all that.
Right. There's no like Haggadah, right. There's no Seder plate with, you know, bitter herbs and whatever, as we would see in the Jewish community now.
That sounds right to me.
But thinking about sort of what resonances we might want to pull out of the Passover meal, the way it's described in Exodus 12, gosh, there are a lot of things that I think could be meaningful. You know, that the lamb that is roasted and eaten, the blood of the lamb is put on the doorposts and at least in the original one. I don't know that people were doing that now. I think that would be a little strange.
Yes.
but they're remembering the time that that happened in Exodus 12. And that is what saved them. It had some kind of like apotropaic function. It was able to protect them from the plague that passed over in Egypt. That brought the death of the firstborn. And I guess that is also what we are facing here, the death of the firstborn of God. Wow, that was already a lot of resonances there. But the another thing I was going to say is that meal is understood to be special, but also eaten in haste because something is going to happen. Like something is about to happen when they eat that meal. And they might not quite, I mean, in Exodus, they really don't understand what it is that's going to happen. And here they don't really understand what it is that's going to happen. Mm. But there's an urgency about the time.
I love that. You know, it's interesting. In the Gospel of John, the timing of the last meal Jesus has with his disciples is actually different. So that Jesus dies on the cross on the day of preparation when the lambs are being sacrificed. Mm-hmm, so in John's version, Jesus sort of is the Passover lamb. Mm-hmm. In this version, it's still clearly drawing a connection to the Passover, but it's not Jesus is the lamb. It's this meal is the same meal, which is now being sort of transposed, I guess, into a Christian register, which still has the same significance of we are about to be saved from this thing that is oppressing us. In the Hebrew Bible, the power of the Pharaoh. In the New Testament, I don't know if it's the power of the Roman Empire, the power of empire, or the power of sin and death, or something, some amalgamation of those. I guess in the Hebrew Bible text, it's also the power of death.
Yeah, it's both. Yeah, that's the thing. You're right. It's both in both cases.
That's exactly
right. There's the oppression of the empire, but there's also death.
Yeah. So here it's the meal that's the common factor, not Jesus is not becoming the lamb, but the meal is the same meal sort of repurposed in a different direction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Bobby, is it new information? I'm sure I should know this, but is it new information to us that it is one of the 12 who will betray him?
That's an interesting question, Amy. When we met the disciples back all the way back in Mark chapter 3, Mark gives us a list, and then in 3:19, he says, and Judas Iscariot, who betrayed Jesus. Mm-hmm. So you and I knew because Mark told us, but nobody in the text knew. Jesus has not said this to anybody. Mm-hmm. And so this is a new detail, not just that it's Judas, but that it's one of Jesus's own followers who's going to betray him.
Right. Yes. And someone sitting in that group around that table.
Yeah.
That just hurts.
It does.
That hurts my heart, Bobby.
You know, it's so interesting. I mean, it does hurt your heart. Like, I mean, and that whole thing about people that I eat with and dipping into the common bowl, like all of this is about, these are my best friends. Like, this is my inner circle. And even in that inner circle, there's someone who can betray. And it's so interesting that all of the other people say, all the other disciples say, it's not me, is it? Surely not I. Which always makes me think, like, deep down inside, like it's not them, right? But deep down inside, they're like, they kind of know that maybe they're actually capable of it or something. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
At Canvas Community, where I worship, the pastor oftentimes, when he's welcoming people to the table where we, you know, where we commemorate this meal, he says Jesus ate with his closest friends, including Peter, who would deny him, and Judas, who betrayed him. And I just think that's like, it's a shocking and terrible thing that he was betrayed and denied. But there is something there about even the one who betrayed him is still welcome at this meal, even though Jesus knows what's coming. So I don't know. So then it sort of says, like, no matter who you are, even if you are as bad a colleague of Jesus, as bad a friend of Jesus as Judas, you can still be at the table with Jesus, which to me is pretty powerful.
Would you think that Jesus knows that it's Judas?
Yes.
Yeah, that is a powerful thing to still invite them to the table. And I think it actually leads directly into the next thing I want to ask you about, which I feel like I'm a broken record with this, Bobby. So I don't know. I apologize. But this next part, woe to the one by whom the Son of Man is betrayed, and then it would have been better for that one not to have been born.
Yeah.
I just don't know a more intense way that you could condemn the wholeness of someone, not just their act, but like really just that that's a very full statement. It would have been better for them not to have been born.
Can you just talk to me a little bit? I mean, I think I know what you mean there. Can you talk to me a little bit about how you understand woe to him?
Mm.
Like, is this a threat? Is this a, just how do you make sense of it?
I guess I don't read it quite as a threat, but more just as a, you know, Jesus has already made these sort of, psychic is definitely not the right word, but has had these situations where clearly he knows how things are going to unfold. Like we had the example of the colt before. In this one we had, you know, there'll be a guy with a jug of water, follow the guy, he'll take you to a house, he'll take you to a room, you know. And so I guess I see this as, I could see it two ways. One is because the soul of this person will suffer so much because of what they are about to do that they will wish they had never been born. Mm-hmm. And the other is it would have been better if they had not been born because what they're going to do is so terrible and it shouldn't happen. Mm-hmm. Those are really different readings.
They are very different readings. And with that second one, I think some people also read it as, you know, that maybe Judas is going to receive his eternal punishment or something, which is an importation into this text. But the punishment for this is going to be so severe. And, you know, I think people might think he's going to be cast into hell or whatever sort of concept of the afterlife one has here. I really like the first way you read it. And honestly, that's my sort of reading of this text is woe can mean like, shame on you, you're going to suffer. Mm-hmm. But woe can also be an expression of like compassionate horror, right? Like, oh my God, like it's so, so terrible for you. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be read with that finger wagging. Mm-hmm. And when you talk about wishing you had not been born, of course, my head goes to Job 3 when Job has lost everything. And he really says, not only he wishes he hadn't been born, but the very, his own birthday had been erased from the calendar. Like, you know, his actual date just didn't exist. Mm. And so I sort of read it that way, is it's going to be this, once you have done this thing, it's going to be so impossible to live with having done this thing that you're going to suffer so much, not because God is making you suffer, but just because you realize the magnitude.
And, oh, I see.
And you wish, you know, you wish you had done something different.
So that in that reading, it doesn't even have to be this sort of like the suffering of your soul, like in a punishment
right
kind of way. It is right. Just you won't be able to live with yourself.
Right. Which is actually how it turns out in one of the other gospels. I forget. One of them, he bursts open.
Mm-hmm.
He, like, and one of them, he hangs himself. Right. Mm. Mark doesn't tell us what happens to Judas. But there's this sense in which he just can't live with what he's done. He's made his own decisions and he's borne the consequences of his own decisions here. I like to think that Jesus yet still is forgiving towards him. I'm reading past the text here, but I don't read Jesus as condemning Judas, but just mm-hmm. recognizing how horrible it's going to be for him to have to live with what he's done.
You know, that the two verses that we didn't read from this chapter, I'm really glad that you summarized in between 10 and 11, where it is clear that Judas is plotting to do this.
Right.
Already. I have so many questions about why he's doing that, but the text doesn't tell us. So
it doesn't.
It just is what it is. I think the thing that I continue to struggle with a little bit is the question of to what extent does Judas really, this is the question I ask you every time. If this is how it has to play out in order for God's planned end to come into being, it just makes me so incredibly sad to see, to see how terrible it will be for the humans who are involved in that. Like, I don't know. I wish there were another way for this to go. I say it every time. I wish there were another way for this to go. I wish there were another way for this to go.
I totally get that. And my broken record response is when I see that this is how it has to be, I don't read that as God set all this in motion and is manipulating the chess pieces, but that this is how God knows people are. And so there is no other way that this could have gone. Mm-hmm. Then the religious elite and the imperial authority were going to do away with Jesus. And then here we get added this other so personal layer of people are such that even one who is in your most inner circle, you never know who might betray you.
Yeah.
And this is a comment on the way people are, not a comment on the way God manipulates fate. And that's how I read it anyway. It doesn't really solve the problem. Like, it's still terrible for Judas. But I don't think God forced Judas to do it and then is like, ha, shame on you for doing that.
Yeah. No, yeah. And your reading is also sad, but a little bit easier. Man, human beings are a mess.
We are. Hi, everyone. It's Bobby here from Bible Worm. We hope you're enjoying the podcast. Amy and I started Bible Worm a couple of years ago because we wanted to create a space where we could talk deeply about the Bible in ways that bring together our academic backgrounds in biblical studies and our deep engagement with communities and people of faith. We decided to make this resource free because we want everyone to have access to sound biblical scholarship that connects biblical faith to everyday life. We hope you're finding the podcast fits that need. That said, while the podcast is free, making it is not. Amy and I and the rest of Team Bible Worm spend a lot of time and energy studying, recording, and editing the podcast to make it freely available to the public. If you enjoy the podcast, and if you find yourself in a position to support our work, we hope that you will consider becoming a Bible Worm supporter for as little as $4 per month. For a bit more, you can also get early access to episodes, weekly liturgies, video Bible studies, join a monthly discussion group, and more. We realize not everyone is in a position to support the podcast, but if you appreciate our work and want to support us, we hope you'll check out our Patreon at patreon.com/BibleWormPodcast for more details. Thanks so much for listening, and now back to this week's podcast.
Should we see what happens next?
Yes.
Maybe it'll get better.
It has a moment. There's a little moment.
Yes, yes, yes. Okay, I'm going to pick up then in verse 22. While they were eating, he took a loaf of bread, and after blessing it, he broke it, gave it to them, and said, "Take, this is my body." Then he took a cup, and after giving thanks, he gave it to them, and all of them drank from it. He said to them, "This is my blood of the covenant, which is poured out for many. Truly I tell you, I will never again drink of the fruit of the vine until that day when I drink it new in the kingdom of God." When they had sung the hymn, they went out to the Mount of Olives, and Jesus said to them, "You will all become deserters, for it is written, 'I will strike the shepherd, and the sheep will be scattered.' But after I am raised up, I will go before you to Galilee." Peter said to him, "Even though all become deserters, I will not." Jesus said to him, "Truly, I tell you, this day, this very night, before the cock crows twice, you will deny me three times." But he said vehemently, "Even though I must die with you, I will not deny you." And all of them said the same. Ooh, okay. Do the same thing. We'll go back to the beginning of this and then get to that more intense part that it builds up to. Bobby, it is a little strange to tell someone, "This is my body."
It is.
What is happening? Like, what do you, I know it's hard probably to think about because there's, you know, all these thousands of years now is a thousands of years now of tradition. But just right here in this text, in Mark's version, how do you understand what is happening?
Yeah, so of course there are long, long Christian traditions of arguing about sacramental theology that I am mostly not well equipped to deal with. But you're right, like Mark is not thinking about that. Mark is doing, you know, he's just telling the story.
Yeah.
The "is there" in the Greek sometimes has been understood to mean like this bread has become my body, this bread has become, or this wine has become my blood. It can also be sort of a like a metaphor. This bread symbolizes my body. This drink symbolizes my blood. And this has been one of the points of controversy in Christian tradition over time, is how literal, how symbolic does Jesus mean all of this? It is, I mean, the offering of one's body and blood, you know, the breaking of the bread there reminds you of the feeding of the 5,000 and the feeding of the 4,000, which I don't think we read this year, but those miracles in which Jesus gave sustenance to the crowds through the breaking of the bread. And so I think one of the ways of reading what's happening when Jesus says, "This is my body," it is sort of offering sustenance for the living of life. And so when a person takes this bread, this that represents Jesus' body, and ingests it, that it is empowering you for the living of the day, something along those lines. Some people will also make the breaking of it significant, which I think is a nice reading of it. I don't know if that's what Mark has in mind or not, but here is bread that is broken in the way that Jesus' body is about to be broken And its brokenness is what allows it to be given as sustenance to others. I'm curious what that sounds like as an outsider to the tradition when you read that or hear that.
Well, I mean, I'm a strange outsider to the tradition in a lot of ways, but
yes.
But what's going through my mind as you're talking is the reference earlier to, you know, someone at this very table with whom I am sharing food will betray me. And just the way that food functioned and functions now in so many societies as like thinking in terms of like the discipline of ritual theory, like thinking very concretely about it, like anthropologically, it connects people to eat together, to have this item that was once one discrete thing, then to break it into pieces and spread it among your bodies. So that was already in my mind before we got here. And then to get here and for Jesus to, in a way, take himself out of the picture and say, like, I'm not just one of the people at the table who is sharing this meal with you, but then to assume a totally different role that usually no one is going to whether you want to say it's metaphorical or not, you know, whatever your theology is, like, I am the thing that will connect you to each other.
Yes. That's lovely.
It is a wild image. This is a very wild thing to say.
Yeah, because Jesus is playing two roles in this moment. One of them is the host of the dinner who is offering food. And then the other is he is the food that is being shared. And it's twisting around those roles of like who is the presiding officer and who is, and it reminds you of, you know, the last will be first and first will be last. And whoever wants to be great among you will become a servant of all. Like Jesus is kind of embodying that. It's both of those roles at the same time.
Does do you have any particular association with blood of the covenant from prior to this text?
Well, so there's a couple of things there. One is, I mean, when I read blood of the covenant, I read the story that you were talking about earlier of the Exodus and the marking of the door. So here's the marking of the people as having a special relationship. Now it's not through the blood on the door, but through the consumption of wine, the blood of Jesus. In the communion liturgy, this is often said, which is poured out for you or poured out for many for the forgiveness of sins. But here, it's not about sin forgiveness. It's just about the blood itself marks the covenant. Mm-hmm. And so it's possible to take communion in sort of a Day of Atonement sort of direction, where there's the cleansing agent that cleanses sin. But I don't actually think that's what Mark is doing here. Mm-hmm. I think Mark is saying this is marking you as people of the covenant, like that first lamb's blood did. Mm-hmm. How do you read that?
I think I'm thinking a few chapters later in Exodus, right after Exodus 24, right after they get you know, laws from Sinai, and the people say, we will do it. And then Moses, they sets up an altar and they have a little sacrifice. And as part of that, he sprinkles blood on the crowds of people and also on the altar. And he calls it the blood of the covenant, like that this somehow marks the parties involved. I mean, he can't put blood on God because that doesn't make any sense, but he puts it on the altar. So again, here, I feel like it's playing with that imagery, but sort of making it more extreme. Instead of just having the blood sprinkled on your body, you will ingest it. And instead of having it sort of put on the altar to indicate a connection to God, like, I guess it depends what Mark's sense of Jesus's relationship to God is, but, you know, Jesus would be the conduit for that covenant.
I really love that connection to Exodus 24, Amy. I had not made that connection myself, but I think that makes so much sense. And you know how it is with rituals, as you often say, is that rituals are not exhausted by any one significance, but they can mean all of these things kind of. The reason you have a ritual and you don't just say what you think is because ritual can communicate beyond a propositional statement.
That's right. That's right. If you could just say the thing, you would just say the thing.
Right.
Yeah. There's so much I want to talk about in here. I'm having a little bit of trouble thinning it out, but I think the next thing that feels incredibly urgent to me is this note that Jesus gives us, I will never again drink the fruit of the vine until after I've died.
Right.
Basically. They haven't known that we're talking about like that kind of time frame, right?
I don't think so.
This is new. They have been told it's coming.
Yes. And you might not be surprised that it's going to happen during the festival because we've kind of been building toward Jerusalem and toward Passover.
Yeah.
But I don't think they have a itinerary.
They don't have an itinerary. And then sort of, okay, fine. So Jesus says this incredibly intense thing. They sing some hymns.
I love that part. Yeah. It's so beautiful to, like, you have this fraught moment as we've been talking about, and the way they draw their time, at least this moment of time, as they sing together. And I mean, you know, they're feeling all the feels. They know what's coming. They, you know,
yeah.
Or at least they know what's coming. They may not know a time frame, so they sing. I really love that.
I love it too. What else would we do with that time?
And it's not mournful songs. It's songs of praise.
But then they get this very, again, sort of like building upon what the text has told us, that someone in this 12 is going to be the one who betrays Jesus. Now it's all of you will become deserters.
Yeah.
So even if you're not the one who betrays me, none of y'all are going to be able to handle what's about to happen.
Yeah.
For me, that is such a, and of course they have difficulty holding on to that information. I mean, it really is, it feels to me like you cannot rely on yourself. Like as strongly as you feel right now, you are not reliable. And that is frightening.
That's so well said, Amy, that in the face of this terrible thing that's happening, even your deepest convictions are going to be challenged, and you're not going to live up to your own goals. It is sad, but it also is so true, right? How quickly, you know, it's really hard. I mean, I've never been faced with anything like this, you know, but I know that there are things that I would fold up my principles for. I'm sure of it. I don't quite know what they are, but
yeah, it's such a painful mirror to hold up to people, because on the one hand, like I want to fight this with everything I've got and be like, you can't just tell people they can't rely on themselves. Like that's a horrible thing to say to someone. And it hurts so much to even read it being said to other people that I don't know, but it just feels so like, what are we supposed to do if we can't rely on our own convictions?
Yeah.
And at the same time, if I can get past that kind of rageful initial response, I know that that is true.
Yeah.
It's just too hard to think about that. I don't know how to be in the world and not be able to trust myself.
You know, in the middle of that, Jesus says in verse 28, after I'm raised up, I will go before you to Galilee, which is the image of the gathering in. And so it's while you're saying, I know I can't trust myself, which I think is exactly what Mark is trying to say, or what Jesus is trying to say here, there, Jesus is saying, even though I know that you are about to betray me, deny me, and run away from me, I'm going to go to Galilee, and I'm going to gather you in. And so you can't trust yourself, but you can trust that Jesus is sure going to be in Galilee where he said he was going to be, and you can be gathered in then. And so Jesus is not going to stand there in Galilee saying, well, you betrayed me, you denied me, you know, and cross you off the list. Jesus says, like, to me, that's the good news here, is you can't trust yourself, but you can trust when Jesus says he's going to be in Galilee to meet you there. He's going to be in Galilee to meet you there. And, you know, forgiveness abounds. So it's scary to think about, and also true of our own sort of frailty, and also ultimately for a Christian reader to rely on Jesus is the point, I think.
No, I think that's exactly right. And I think as painful as it is to hold up, like, pretty clearly, you can't rely on yourself. I think that is precisely the point it's making, is
yeah,
you can't rely on yourself, but that doesn't mean it's over.
Right. Right.
It means that you have to rely on God. Like you can't rely on yourself.
This is one of the places where my two different kind of worshiping contexts reads really differently. Like in my church of people that are sort of my situation in life, we all want to be self-reliant and we all want to be able to trust ourselves. And it's kind of offensive to say that we can't, you know? At Canvas Community, where many people are homeless, like they full well know, you know, a lot of them have struggled with addiction. They struggle with untreated mental illness. They've been in jail. They know that they're not reliable. And so the message here that you don't have to be reliable, Jesus is reliable, is really, really good news. So it kind of sounds different, I think, depending on on your own attachment to your own reliability.
Yeah, that's making me think back, Bobby, to some of our conversations about like why having a bunch of personal possessions makes it so difficult to get into this kingdom because you have a sense that you can rely on yourself. And for many things, you can.
Yeah.
And that is not a good muscle to build up. You don't want to build up the muscle of relying on yourself because
you are unreliable.
You are ultimately unreliable. Maybe you can set up some situations where you rely on yourself, but that's not what's going to carry the day.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything else you'd like to raise up from here, or shall we press through to the end?
The only thing I would sort of add there is that this is exactly the way it turns out. Peter does, in fact, deny Jesus three times before the rooster crows. Everybody else runs away. And there's, I forget exactly where it is, it's somewhere in chapter 15. There's a notice that one of Jesus's followers ran away so fast that somebody grabbed his cloak while he was running by and he just ran away naked, which I always think is funny, but it's just a symbol of like how fast everyone, like how desperate they turn out to be to abandon Jesus. I don't know that that really is all that important, but as firm as they all are here, it turns out that Jesus is exactly right about how they're going to respond.
Yep. Yep. And we're going to see just in this next section, the beginning of the beginning of the ways that they're not able to do what they need to do. All right, I will pick up then in verse 32. They went to a place called Gethsemane, and he said to his disciples, "Sit here while I pray." He took with him Peter and James and John and began to feel distressed and agitated. And he said to them, "I am deeply grieved, even to death. Remain here and keep awake." And going a little farther, he threw himself on the ground and prayed that, if it were possible, the hour might pass from him. He said, "Abba, Father, for you all things are possible. Remove this cup from me. Yet not what I want, but what you want." He came and found them sleeping. And he said to Peter, "Simon, are you asleep? Could you not keep awake 1 hour? Keep awake and pray that you may not come into the time of trial. The spirit indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak." And again he went away and prayed, saying the same words. And once more he came and found them sleeping, for their eyes were very heavy, and they did not know what to say to him. He came a third time and said to them, "Are you still sleeping and taking your rest? Enough! The hour has come. The Son of Man is betrayed into the hands of sinners. Get up, let us be going. See, my betrayer is at hand." Okay, this is there's not much humor to be found in this text, but here's a humorous memory I had of really, really in the sufferings of labor. And my spouse kept falling asleep, being like, "I'm hungry. I'm going to get something to eat." And I was like, "I hate you so much." But really, the flesh is weak, Bobby. We're just a mess. We're a mess.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. Yes.
Can you talk to me about how you understand Jesus's internal experience here or what you see in this particular, you know, in Mark's rendition of it.
Yeah. To me, this is just such a powerful portrayal of Jesus. And, you know, we've been a little bit hard on the disciples along the way for not being able to handle what's coming and for betraying Jesus and running away. And here we see Jesus coming really, really close. And, you know, he had asked James and John back in chapter 10, can you drink this cup? And they said, we can. And then here's Jesus saying, please take this cup from me, which is, I mean, he is as close as you can get to yielding. So I really, like, I like that portrayal of Jesus because it is such a human one and such an anguished one. And there's a sense in which if Jesus were all like nonchalant about what was happening here, you would think like, he doesn't really get it. You know, he doesn't know what it's like to be me, but here is Jesus who suffers and is about to give up in the ways that we suffer and are about to give up. And he finds it in himself. And, you know, where he, what he keeps saying is, I don't want to do this, but not what I want, but what you want. And so he keeps sort of submitting, saying, I'll do what I have to do, but I really don't want to do it. And that's the thing that he says that gets him through. Yeah. So anyway, this is a very relatable image of Jesus to me. And I am grateful that it is in the in this text.
Yeah.
What is your impression as you read it?
I think it's really it's really pretty similar. I mean, I was moved that I was moved particularly by the way that he wants company, but he also wants privacy.
Yeah.
You know, he asks them to come with him and he tells them that he's really distressed, but then he goes away from them to pray. Maybe he doesn't want them to see this human, you know, he also is in a body of flesh and he, and flesh is weak and, you know, and I wonder if the disciples would have fallen asleep if they had been able to see his distress. Like, I wonder what it is to protect your followers from your distress versus to let them be in it with you. Although from what they've said before, they probably would have tried to prevent things from happening that needed to happen. So, but I think you're exactly right that this is not a text that says, oh, you're suffering. Don't worry about that. Just think about Jesus. Like this is a text that says like, Jesus really gets it.
Yes.
Jesus gets it.
Yes.
And I think that's really important.
The line that Jesus says there to Simon, in verse 37, couldn't you stay awake for 1 hour? And then 38, stay alert and pray so you won't give in to temptation. Like, this is about the story that we're reading, right? Like, stay awake while I'm praying. This is also about Christians in the post-resurrection era who are meant to be waiting for Jesus to return from wherever Jesus has gone. And there is a danger here of falling asleep, like Simon falls asleep in this story. And so we've seen this in the little apocalypse and in other places about staying awake because the time is near. So I think we Christian readers are meant to hear ourselves there in that Simon text as well.
Yeah.
I also think maybe this is the only place in Mark where Jesus calls somebody by their proper name.
Oh yeah?
Simon.
It's funny that he said to Peter, Simon.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's funny if you read it as he messed up his name. I know that.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
Yeah.
It was such an intimate moment, right? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that intimacy and calling God Abba, you know, Father in Aramaic, like is that, I don't know. I know lots of kids who call their fathers Abba. Like, it just has such a deeply personal relationship to God and personal relationship to the disciples. I guess I shouldn't be surprised, but I am, that we don't get any idea what God says back to him.
I hadn't really thought about that, Amy, but But you're right. And whether he is comforted at the end of this, I mean, he goes back three times.
And then finally he says, the hour has come. It's time.
Time's up. Yeah.
So I don't know if that's, he had a, you know, some kind of sense of understanding, some kind of communication. But I mean,
yeah.
I don't know what that experience was like, or if he just sort of poured his heart out in prayer and then was like, okay, mm-hmm. let's do it.
You know, in the Good Friday text in this gospel, when Jesus dies on the cross, his last words are, my God, why have you forsaken me? Which I think can be read as Jesus has not been feeling God's presence, certainly in that moment. And I think you could probably read that back. I mean, we're only a few hours before the crucifixion when we're reading this text. And so I think it's entirely reasonable to think that Jesus has not heard back from God. And he sort of steals himself with this, not your will, but my will. And then he says, I'm gonna do it because I know it's what needs to be done. If you read it that way, it's helpful to me because I feel like this is often my experience too.
Yeah.
Even when I feel God respond to me, I'm never 100% clear that that's what I'm actually experiencing. I just have some sort of experience that I... So there's a lot of silence for me. And so being able to still press ahead, even when what you've got is silence in response, seems helpful to me.
No, I think that is, again, very, very relatable. This is a very relatable Jesus that we get here.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really still trying to hold on to the idea that this is not just the saddest story in the world.
It's a sad story
for a Jew. If you don't get past the crucifixion part and be like, this whole other thing happened, then it's an enormously sad story.
Yeah.
Is there anything else you would like to add about this section before we start to move toward a close?
I guess I just want to, like, Peter and the disciples, I can just totally see myself doing this, you know, like falling asleep. It's the middle of the night. Like, I'm tired. Jesus is gone someplace. I don't know where he is. I don't know what he's doing. Like I get it why they keep falling asleep. And so, like, I can be a little judgy about them sometimes. Like, come on, man. Like, all in the world you had to do was stay awake. But I also relate to them, I guess.
It's interesting, Bobby, because for some reason I hadn't thought of this before, but I was talking before about Exodus 24 when there is that phrase, the blood of the covenant, and there's the covenant at Sinai. And then shortly after that, Moses is, you know, getting information about the tabernacle that they're supposed to build and is not visible to the people for a while. And the people lose their minds and start making a golden calf and start, you know, it's again, like they don't go directly with the person they can see in a body who is representing God's presence in their lives. And I don't know, humans can just only go so long. Not that they made a golden calf. They didn't make a golden calf.
Right.
But their humanness overpowered their ideals, I guess.
Yeah.
Oh, Bobby, I am glad and also overwhelmed that we read this text together.
Yes.
But here we are at the end of it. What is bubbling up for you?
I mean, this text is such a key one in my tradition. And so to sort of say, like, well, here's the significance of Maundy Thursday and the Lord's Supper is kind of a daunting task. But I think what I am drawn to and often think about with this text, and also just in the celebration of communion itself, is that Jesus knows full well from the beginning of this text that he's sharing this meal with people who are ultimately not going to live up to their obligations. And so he's having a meal with people he knows are going to deny him and abandon him, people he knows are going to betray him. And yet he shares a meal with them anyway, and he offers them symbols of his body and his blood anyway. And he says, you know, this is a foreshadowing of the crucifixion. Like, I'm going to lay down my life for you anyway. And that text that we were just talking about where Jesus says, you're going to scatter and run away, but I'm going to meet you in Galilee after the resurrection. To me, that combination is so lovely. And we were talking about it before, but the key message to me in this text is you do not have to deserve the thing that Jesus has decided to do for you in this events of the crucifixion and resurrection, the giving of his body and of his blood, that Jesus is the one who is reliable in this equation. And Jesus is going to be in Galilee after the resurrection, even though you abandon him, even though you betray him, even though you don't live up to your obligations. And so when I read this text and when I celebrate communion, that's what I focus on, is the reliability of Jesus, even in the midst of human frailty and of my own frailty.
Mm.
And I also, you know, that we were talking before about Jesus in the garden. He knows what that frailty is like. He doesn't break in the end like Peter and Judas and the other disciples and I do, but he knows what it's like. And that's comforting to me to know that, you know, Jesus understands how hard it is to be human and to face the things that we face. And Jesus is prepared to meet us in Galilee anyway. So I think that's what I'm taking away. It's nothing. I mean, it's both not profound and also deeply.
It is deeply profound. Yes, yeah. It is deeply profound. Mm-hmm. It is deeply profound.
What about you when you're reading this text for something like the first time? What are you taking away from it?
Bobby, I think what is sort of holding my heart right now, finishing this text, is, okay, so you know how there are sort of caricatures, not true portrayals, but caricatures of Jews as being sort of obsessed with law and sort of like kind of missing the big picture, but trying to check all the boxes and, you know, maybe that could lead to self-righteousness, maybe that could lead to whatever, right?
Sure.
Okay, so that's the extreme caricature. And there is a caricature, also untrue, of Christian folks that because they don't have all this law stuff and because they have Jesus who will meet them at Galilee anyway, that they kind of can do whatever they want and then just be like, it's cool because Jesus.
Right.
What I love about this text is that it's holding us in the middle of this really painful but really true place in between them where everyone is really giving their full, wholehearted commitment and effort. Like, nobody is just saying, well, if I'm gonna, you know, like, if we know already that I'm not gonna be able to do it, I would rather go back to my mom's house and like hang out there than sit in this cold valley with you while you do whatever right. You're doing. That's unthinkable. Like, that would be crazy in this situation. But I feel like the tension of the story holds open this possibility for all of us that we do still put in the full wholehearted effort.
Mm.
And when we do, we will discover that we cannot do everything and it will be heartbreaking.
Mm. Yes.
And that is the moment where we are caught in this like web of God's love and holding of us.
Mm-hmm.
But there's no, I really want, humans don't like suffering. And so I really want there to be a shortcut around it one way or the other. It could be follow all the laws. It could be, it doesn't matter because you're cool because you have Jesus. Like, if there's some way we could avoid this heartbreaking place, that would be so great. Except it wouldn't, because then you don't get that feeling. You don't get caught in that web of love that will hold you in the same way.
Mm-hmm.
I think both what is so distressing to me about this story is also what's so beautiful to me about this story.
Mm.
That there's not an easier way, because until people have been have had their hearts. There's a lot of teaching in Jewish tradition about the importance of having your heart broken.
Mm.
And how many different ways can you let it be broken? And by how many different stories can it be broken?
Yeah.
And every time it is broken, it opens up some possibility of connection between you and the divine. And this is, in that kind of way, I see this as an incredibly heartbreaking story. But, you know, if we don't want to have our hearts hardened, then they need to be broken.
That's beautiful, Amy.
And no cigarettes were smoked in the creation of this episode.
Yeah, no new piercings so far.
No, nothing new was pierced in the creation of this podcast. No. All right, my friend. Next time we meet, we will talk about Mark chapter 16, verses 1 through 8. That's such a short reading.
It is a short reading. It is the shortest of the Easter stories and also the one in which you never actually see the resurrected Jesus, which makes for an interesting Easter.
And it's our last week in Mark.
It is our last week in Mark. It's true.
Oh, I will miss Mark.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Good old Mark.
Good old
Mark. I really love Mark. You know, it's a good gospel.
Yeah. Well, I look forward to that next conversation with you. And until then, take good care.
Okay. You too, Amy.
Okay. Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for joining us for this week's episode of Bible Worm. If you've enjoyed this free podcast, we hope you'll help us keep it going by joining our Patreon for as little as $4 per month. You can also sign up for other goodies like early access, video lectures, weekly liturgies, and more. Visit patreon.com/Bibleworm podcast for details.
Bible Worm is produced and edited by Bobby Williamson. Our theme song is sung by Colin Bagby, and our theme music is The World at Large by Dano Songs. Many thanks to all of our Patreon supporters for helping make this podcast possible.
Next week, we'll have our last week together in the book of Mark. We'll read his account of the Easter story in chapter 16, verses 1 through 8. Until then, keep on digging.